This is Future Water, where we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, it's all about disasters. No, not that one. We're going to talk about natural disasters and water and wastewater infrastructure management related to it. I am Reese Tisdale, and today I'm joined by Bluefield Research Directors Eric Bindler and Aaron Bonnie Casey. Hey guys, how's it going?
Good. Glad to be here today.
Yeah, going great. Good to talk to you guys.
You guys sound pretty enthusiastic to be on. So let's sort of dive into this. I mean, I think one of the things, obviously we've talked a lot about COVID, but there are other disasters that seem to be happening. These are ones that we know about every year. And before we get to the questions that I have for you guys and the work you've been doing, in recent years, we have been looking at NOAA data, which tracks billion-dollar disasters in the U.S. And since 1980, according to some data that we have from them, the number's going up year over year. And by that, I mean cumulatively, as well as annually, steadily. So to give you some background, from 1980 to 2019, the U.S. has sustained 258 weather and climate-related events. Weather and climate, the same thing. So for those deniers out there, I just want to keep you in check. But in this time, that same period, the number per year has risen from 3 per year in the 1980s to 12 per year in this past decade. So the numbers show that it's going up. And these disasters include everything from hurricanes to flooding to winter storms, as well as wildfires. And I'll tell you what, now that I think about it, I will talk to the marketing team this week. Every week, Bluefield puts out its waterline newsletter, which provides, you know, news items that you can sort of read more about the week, curate, or think that are interesting, as well as showcasing some of our insights. But this is a good exhibit to share with other headlines and insights. So I'll talk to them. If you go to our website, you can sign up for the newsletter. I think it's pretty interesting. Could be hopefully helpful. I think clients like it as well. So that's where I will showcase that data in the Waterline newsletter. So with some questions for you guys, California's on fire again, speaking of disasters, and it's also hurricane season. I guess even, was it last week, we had the, what's a good name for the two hurricanes hitting the Gulf Coast? You know, while climate change is a chronic issue, these disruptive events bring on more acute challenges for cities and municipalities, as we know. But one thing we're always considering, at least at Bluefield, is the water side of the equation. And obviously in the case of California, water is used to put out fires, but it seems like the risks go way beyond that. And these are things that we need to consider. So Aaron, when you think about wildfires and hurricanes, what are some of those other problems?
In my mind, I think there's three main things to think about when you're talking about risk to utilities. So the first is failure of the power grid. And that's something that I think we all think about in terms of these disasters, because we've all experienced it and we know how disruptive it is to our own lives. And it's an important thing for water utilities as well. No power for pumping means no water. And it also means no way to pump wastewater where it needs to go. We saw that really play out in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy a few years ago in New York and New Jersey, because the power was out in that case for several days or even several weeks in some communities. So there's a definite need for water utilities to make sure that they have backup power available. And that's also something that individuals should be thinking about as well. When we're all facing the potential of a power outage, whether that be from a hurricane or fires or blizzard, we all make sure our devices are fully charged. We should also be making sure that our Nalgene's are full of water in case there's a disruption to the water supply as well.
Now, this. Are you holding back from saying bathtubs? To fill your bathtubs.
Fill your bathtubs. Well, that's what my father would always recommend too. Make sure that you have water in your bathtub for flushing toilets and things like that. So
I'm not that old, but thanks.
The second thing I would think about in terms of preparing for a disaster is at a utility is workforce management. Utilities need to physically be able to get their people to work sites. So that's a problem with any natural disaster, the movement of people. Obviously, fires or hurricanes interrupt the movement of people. But I think probably the biggest issue is probably around flooding. And we saw that play out in Houston in the floods from Hurricane Harvey a couple of years ago, and water utilities having to find boats in order to get operators physically to those sites. And then compounding that problem around flooding, wastewater treatment plants are usually at the most downstream point in your network, which makes sense because then you can take advantage of gravity to get sewage to the plant. But it also means that that piece of infrastructure is going to flood first. And with the increased incidence of flooding related to climatic changes, that's going to be an increasing problem. And then the third thing I would say, and I know we were kind of saying we were going to get away from talking about COVID, but I'm still going to talk about COVID a little bit. In the past, utilities have been really thinking about, you know, these kind of disruptions to physically getting workers to sites. But now COVID has presented this new set of challenges where not only are you worried about how do you get someone through floodwaters, but in this case, we're talking about how do you get your utility operators safely to work sites, keeping their distance, and also thinking about redundancies in your workforce. So if one of your staff falls sick and they're the only one that knows how to fix the problem, like what do you do in that case? So I think it's a different dynamic in terms of workforce management in this kind of disaster.
I think that's a really good point. When you think about, it was always hard enough, I think, as a hurricane came or as you're in the middle of a fire, you have to set up command centers and you've got to feed the people that are working in the command centers as well as monitor their comings and goings. But also now you got to just, are they healthy or not? And everybody's run down. I know these are acute resource intensive events. So it just compounds the problem, I think. And I don't know, maybe Eric, you may have some other thoughts as well. I mean, from your perspective, because you look at it maybe more from the digital or communication side of things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think those are all great points and just a couple others to consider. I mean, I think building on Aaron's point about redundancies and especially kind of redundancies in knowledge, you know, we hear all the time about the aging workforce in the water industry. And this is potentially even more of a challenge when you're talking about the middle of a disaster situation. You know, for many utilities, especially smaller utilities, you may have just a small handful, maybe one or two kind of veteran operators that really know the system best, right? Like where certain valves are located or whether or not a specific fire hydrant is operable at any given point. And if it's not safe for these workers, you know, for kind of more senior workers to leave their homes in the middle of a disaster, especially when you factor in those additional risks of COVID-19, then there needs to be some kind of mechanism for the rest of the utility staff to access critical institutional knowledge that their colleagues might have in order to keep the system running during the disaster. I mean, especially if you think about situations where you may have reserve operators from another town or just third party kind of contractors coming in to help manage the disaster, they need to know where things are. And if you've got that knowledge kind of concentrated in the hands of a couple particularly vulnerable workers, then that's a challenge. I think another really important dimension to think about is just the communications piece, right? Utilities have a range of communications options or strategies available for connecting their workers, for kind of collecting data and monitoring what's going on with their remote assets. So these could include, you know, radio or radio frequency based cellular satellite communications, LPWAN, like, you know, NB-IoT, for example. And these all have different strengths and weaknesses in disaster situations. So, you know, a commercial cellular network, you may run the risk of seeing that network getting overloaded as people are trying to check in with their friends and family. You know, placing a cell phone call is always really tough in the middle of a disaster. So in some cases, a kind of a dedicated utility-owned radio network might actually be more reliable for some of those mission-critical transmissions, like maintaining control or maintaining contact with your remote pump stations, with your storage tanks. On the flip side, in the event of a disaster that's actually damaging or causing outages of communications network infrastructure, you may actually be better off with cellular carriers because they're more likely to come in and get their networks up and running again than if a utility's got their own kind of dedicated radio infrastructure that gets damaged. It's going to take some time for them to kind of get that fixed and up and running again. So really, I think at the end of the day, I mean, redundancy is kind of the name of the game. You know, we've even heard examples of utility staff having multiple different cell phones on multiple different carriers' networks just in case any one of those networks goes down. And then I guess the third point that I would make is that disasters can do pretty significant damage to water resources and assets themselves, right? So we saw this in Australia with the bushfires last year. The fires damaged pump stations as well as a water treatment plant in the state of South Australia. And then we also saw some issues with ash from the bushfires washing into dams and reservoirs in New South Wales. And so in both cases, really crucial municipal water supplies were taken offline for at least some time, at least a couple of days, as the utility was kind of struggling to deal with that damage or to deal with that contamination.
Yeah, I think we're also related to that. And maybe this is closer to home in California, thinking about, was it the Paradise Fire? I believe it was last year, where the existing infrastructure in the ground was melted in some cases. And, you know, if you're dealing with PVC, they have to completely be replaced. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of, I don't know if there are lessons learned. It's always, once it's already underway, as we're learning because of COVID, but also in the middle of a disaster, whether it be wildfire or not, if you're not prepared for the event beforehand, you're kind of out of luck. Because I think while there's, Eric, as you mentioned, communications and talking about just even damage, physical damage to the networks, the other challenge is everybody's maybe using the network, right? So there may be so much demand. Think about September 11th, for instance. I remember after that, that you couldn't make a phone call in or out of the New York, New Jersey area because of just the high demand on the systems. And I think lastly, I would say, you know, further complicating the wildfires in California is just the scale and fragmentation of the market. And also, I mean, there are thousands of water systems, but there are also a number of different jurisdictions influencing preparedness. And it's hard enough as it is in a place like California, but when things are moving so quickly, the difficulty is exponential in its scale. So that's the big picture, guys. So Eric, what do you think can be done to be more prepared? I mean, what are some examples that you can think of as far as whether it be, you know, clients you're working with or technologies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think certainly from a digital perspective, there are a number of really interesting ways that existing digital water solutions that may be deployed for everyday water, wastewater, stormwater management can also play a really important role in these kind of extraordinary disaster events like wildfires, hurricanes, freezes, for example. You know, I think maybe the first one that comes to mind and maybe the most obvious one is just any type of remote monitoring or remote control capabilities. So you could be talking about, you know, remote pressure or level sensors on the network. You could be talking about online water quality monitors, data loggers, any kind of remote or cloud-based SCADA software. You know, all of that really can play a pretty big role in disaster response, since it would allow utility operators to just maintain visibility of what's going on in their networks and make sure that things are working, you know, kind of ensure operational continuity. Even if, to Aaron's point earlier, they can't physically access key infrastructure, they can't physically access the plant, they can't physically go out to sampling sites, but they can kind of see what's going on from that central command center. I mean, that's all really valuable in the middle of an emergency situation. You know, you mentioned clients that we're working with. I mean, I think Trimble is one that shared some really interesting case studies in this area where, you know, utilities kind of being able to keep an eye on sewer levels and really kind of flood levels essentially with teledata loggers, even after their SCADA sites had gone down in the middle of like Superstorm Sandy or other kind of extreme storm events. And this also is really important in the age of COVID, right? Because again, if you're able to keep kind of reduce the need for site visits and kind of keep people from going out into the field, out into the public, and just kind of keep track of things remotely, you're able to kind of ensure that social distancing that's required. Digital work and asset management technologies are also another really kind of beneficial set of technologies in the middle of disasters. So if a utility field staff can easily access accurate, you know, for example, ArcGIS maps of their assets with maintenance data, condition data, you know, looking at all that on their, you know, maybe their smartphone, their tablet, they won't be wasting precious time trying to find the nearest manhole or trying to operate a valve that might not be working if they've already got that information at their fingertips. You know, again, especially in that situation where we're talking about maybe a junior operator or just somebody from another town, an operator from another community that's been brought in to kind of help deal with a disaster, rather than that one veteran operator who kind of knows where everything is. You know, and it may not really be the top priority in the middle of disaster, but if utility operators have a good process in place for collecting data via mobile devices in the middle of, you know, while they're out doing their work, they can kind of capture what's happening on the network. They can figure out what's breaking, where it's breaking, why it's breaking, what's being done to fix it, really kind of capture all that data in the middle of the disaster. It can be really valuable for kind of thinking about future disasters, helping utilities kind of model out how their system performed in those conditions and plan accordingly for the next disaster.
I'll interrupt you there for a second. One thing to think about is, I assume it's probably pretty nice where you guys are right now. It's climate controlled. Things are good. But when you're in the middle of a snowstorm or a hurricane, or having to search around and figure out what to do or where to look during challenging conditions, it kind of makes things worse. So this may sound obvious, but you have to remember the fact that usually when you need someone to do all of this, they aren't optimal conditions.
Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's kind of the point about the data capture too. If you're trying to carry around a clipboard with a bunch of paper and jotting down everything that you're doing while you're in the middle of a blizzard, like, it's probably not going to happen. But the utility has already kind of rolled out these mobile workforce management solutions, kind of mobile data capture solutions. And as they're going through the work, they're kind of plugging stuff in. Or once they get back to the truck, they quickly kind of enter in what they did on an app and then move on to the next job. Then all of that data can be really valuable in kind of responding to the next disaster.
Yeah, and I think that was something that prompted, I remember hearing George Hawkins at DC Water, I don't know if this was after he was at DC or during that time, but he was talking about, you know, one of their early days, if I recall, walking through a blizzard, having to go find out where either a pipe or a valve was to repair, because there was a main break during a blizzard in DC.
And then just the last quick point I would make in terms of technology, I mean, I think one way of kind of taking people out of that situation where they're having to deal with those problems physically, I mean, I think is when you're getting into like advanced optimization solutions, right? So technologies like, for example, MNET or OptiRTC that can really help utilities prevent flooding and sewer overflows in the middle of extreme rain events, right? These are kind of technologies that use, you know, AI or predictive analytics, real-time network monitoring to basically kind of monitor and predict the impacts of weather events on wastewater and stormwater infrastructure and, you know, use that kind of intelligent technology to basically move flows around within the system to ensure that storage capacity is being maximized and that any kind of strain on the network is minimized. And so, you know, that in addition to those tools to kind of empower operators, this is something that kind of runs alongside to do some of that work automatically to make sure that the system is running to optimal capacity and that any kind of extreme rain maybe in one part of the network can be mitigated by moving some things around in the system in other parts of the network and prevent flooding and overflows.
Yeah, that's an interesting area that, you know, stormwater overall is something that I know we get a lot of questions about, but also, you know, one, who's managing it or how to manage it. Just also because there are a lot of players involved in stormwater, whether it be Department of Transportation, whether it be Parks and Rec, whether it be the municipal utility or the city itself. So it's interesting to see how different companies, you mentioned Opti and MNET, you know, how they're approaching it. And I know there are a number of others, but that's a longer term play. And I think they're basically responding to what the data is telling us. Like I started at the beginning, that there are more and more large storm events that are having greater impacts financially, but also just on people's lives. And so finding ways to mitigate it is, we think, is an opportunity. So, well, Aaron, I mean, back to you, what about other things that utilities can do even outside of just digital and other challenges maybe that they face?
So I talked about the issues around the power grid failure, and that is one thing that we're seeing utilities really invest in is on-site power generation. So whether that be making sure you have enough generators or investing in microgrid solutions, there's a lot of money going to that right now in kind of disaster preparation. I know that the IOUs in California have allocated tens of millions of dollars to ensure that they can continue operating in a disaster, especially if the power goes out, because I know with the wildfires in California, they're often shutting off power kind of as a prevention, make sure that they're not starting more fires. So that's definitely, you know, something that we see happening. And also with on-site generation, looking at solar panels and battery storage, like I mentioned, microgrids, there's a lot of new technology in that space that utilities are taking advantage of. And then the other thing I would mention, Eric has been talking about, you know, digital solutions that allow you to communicate with your workforce and with your assets. I would also point out that you should be thinking about how to communicate with the public as well. That's always a challenge for water utilities, one I think that the industry as a whole is increasingly addressing, but it's especially important during a disaster and figuring out what's a robust way to engage your consumers and get the message out. So, you know, we were kind of joking before, but are there preemptive steps that consumers can take, like filling water bottles or their bathtub? Or even if you're thinking about a deep freeze, there are steps that individual households can take preemptively to try and avoid pipe bursting related to freezing events. So I think utilities should remember that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And if there are easy things that the public can do to help mitigate some of the worst effects of a disaster, then it's definitely worth engaging them in that process.
I think one thing, you know, back to like wildfires in the past, some utilities, if I recall, was it City of Ventura in 2017? I mean, they're being sued because they did not have backup generation. So they weren't even prepared. So, and part of that, I think the ruling or court rulings have been, well, you're a monopoly. You should be prepared for these things. So it's not as if the water utilities are off the hook. I'm not saying that's fair. They didn't start the fire. I think in that case, it may have been PG&E. And I think there are a couple other examples. So I know several utilities, they are sort of pushing back saying, hey, we're not responsible for this stuff. Another question I have for you, Aaron, though, is, I mean, there's also, we've talked a little bit before the disaster, during the disaster, the extent that it can be managed or monitored. But what about after? I know that there are concerns about ash runoff. I mean, that's a big issue as well in the after effects of a wildfire, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, Eric touched on ash runoff causing water quality issues in reservoirs. You're also going to see water, like longer term water quality issues if you have a flood event, especially if you have sewage spills related to that. So just keep in mind, even after the acute disaster is over, you're probably going to have some kind of cleanup and repair and rehabilitation of your system to do. So kind of don't take your eye off the prize when the immediate crisis has passed.
Yeah, we don't even know what's going to happen. I know we have colleagues in California, and I think someone just the other day was talking about, you know, they were driving, I believe, from Seattle, I believe, down to Southern California, and they stopped and were having soup outside, and there was like ash sprinkling into their soup. But also just as it runs off, not just in that way, but just, you know, from rain, once the rainy season comes, it could be a problem. So look, I mean, I think those are some of our general thoughts on what's happening. I know we've been talking to a number of these companies that we've mentioned, but before we go, and if you guys have anything else to add, feel free, but what else are you guys working on as far as research-wise that we should be looking out for? Why don't we start with you, Eric?
Sure. So I'm kind of working on going our global digital water project database, partly just for our kind of regular quarterly insights, but also just to better understand the impacts that COVID-19 has been having on the digital water market, you know, and how, what those impacts look like by country, by technology type. You know, I think our view is still very much that the pandemic is going to result in some kind of long-term digital acceleration in the water utility sector, you know, and really for a lot of the reasons that we've been talking about, right? Utilities are increasingly seeing the value of things like remote monitoring and control, mobile work and asset management, advanced optimization or automation solutions, in part because they can help build resilience and redundancy in the face of COVID-19, but also to help with any of these other disasters that we've been talking about, right? You know, there's kind of a lot of parallel applications and cross-functional uses that these technologies serve, not just in day-to-day operations, but also under pandemic conditions or under crisis conditions. And utilities, I think, are really starting to see that more and more with the experiences of the past few months. But also going through this project data now is really helpful in understanding, you know, if that's what we view as the long-term outcome, you know, what's kind of happening now? Where are we seeing some cuts being made in the short term? Where are investments starting to ramp up in digital water? And, you know, how does all that affect our digital water forecasting efforts?
Nice. And what about you, Aaron?
Yeah, so I'm also working on revamping some of our forecasts, looking primarily at the municipal water space in the U.S. and then also globally. You know, this is something that we do annually, but there's an extra kind of aggressive push.
It feels like monthly now.
Yeah, because we're really trying to get a handle on, at a granular level, what are the impacts that COVID is having. And we're coming up with some really interesting data about the differing impacts across states and across different asset classes and across different countries when you're talking globally. And so we're modeling all of that out. And also capital improvement plan data. So we've looked at individual cities, how they've changed their plans going forward in light of COVID, or how they haven't, because we're also seeing that. And so we're going to present all of that forecasting information and kind of COVID scenario data in a webcast later in September. So I'll just put in a little plug for that because I think it's going to be a really interesting presentation and hopefully provide a lot of value for our clients. So hopefully people will be able to join that.
Yeah, I think because we've had a couple of clients who asked for impacts early on in the pandemic, and now they're coming back around to say, hey, how have things changed? Because, you know, everybody's sort of trying to figure out not only the virus itself and closures and quarantining impacts, but also what's the impact on industry as well as just state budgets, right? So we just went through all those 40 or so CIPs just to get a gauge on the ones that were recently released. So
yeah, and that first forecasting exercise we did around COVID was really a quick and dirty sketch of what the industry could expect. But now that COVID has been playing out for a few months, and you know, we're in Massachusetts and Eric is in Florida, and those dynamics have looked really different across those states. So we're starting to see that it's going to play out differently depending on kind of where you're at, where you started the pandemic at and where you are now.
And then I think the other layer, it's an election season, right? So we're in the throes of that, and it will be interesting to see what happens on the other side of that. And by that, I mean, you know, what's going to happen with obviously the presidency, but also what happens with at the Senate level, because they're potentially their budget or spending impacts, potentially. Everybody's been talking about infrastructure week for several years now. So as I may have said on this podcast before, I've said it definitely in other places, and that is we're still not at a stimulus phase. We're still, it feels like emergency or crisis management across the board. So ultimately, we are going to need to bring people back to work because I think a lot of jobs aren't going to be there. So that hopefully will be at least maybe scenarios or some, there will be discussions around that in the upcoming webcast as well, which is for right now, it's for clients only. So for those, if you're lucky enough to be listening to this, you should see if you can get in on that and just reach out to us and become a client, should I say. There's another plug. But all right, guys. So I think that's enough for today. Off we go. So thanks again for stepping up. I hope you guys are well. And wherever you may be, we're in three different states today. So you guys take care. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Reese.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
All right. So this podcast and these water insights have been brought to you by Bluefield Research, the one and only. You can always learn more at bluefieldresearch.com. And if you haven't, there are a number of free reports there, which are at your fingertips. I think all you have to do is register. It's pretty simple. It's not even a long process. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe to The Future of Water, which is this podcast, but also don't forget to look at Dave McGimpsey's Water Values podcast. That's a good one to listen to. He's been doing it for a long time. I think he's probably at episode 160 or so. So his archive is pretty good. He's got a lot of great guests, and I think he's, as I've always said, best in the biz. So guys, thanks again, everybody. You can hear more about this and other podcasts from Bluefield on iTunes and other podcast platforms. Everybody, take care. Talk soon.